Blog Talk Radio.
Jeff, Karen, Kat, are you ready for this
one? UCR.
Go.
We say and hope we want, give it to you non-stop. Any place, anytime, not afraid to speak our mind. That's just the way we roll, we never gonna settle. Unstoppable, original, uncensored radio.
Happy Thursday, Rule Breakers. This is No Rules, Just Mics, the No Rules radio show that's bringing you the latest and sometimes controversial topics you want to know. We are your No Rules host. I am Topher, always here for you. I am having a great night tonight, and right next to me is my friend, Burson. Chris, how are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic.
Excellent, excellent. Christian decided he was going to be a big nerd and take tonight off because he has a concert. So we will not be hearing from him, but we have on the phone, he's not going to be stringing a call tonight, but we have him on the line, we have Toku. Toku, what's going on?
What's up, people? I'm here. Sorry I missed yesterday, but circumstances have been bad for me lately.
Yeah, well, let's hope they get better.
Yep.
So we have a couple of things that we want to talk about, but first, let's start making up some really awful rumors about Christian and post them to his Twitter page for missing our show for a concert. So, you know, the concert's called Alabama Shakes. And I don't know, Bursa, that sounds kind of sketchy to me. Is there a real band called Alabama Shakes?
When I heard about it, I thought of shakes like maybe coming down from drugs or maybe caffeine shakes. I'm not quite sure. I'm not one to make snap judgments, but it's what it sounds like. And if it sounds like a duck and it looks like a duck,
it's Christian.
Well, there you go.
What it is?
It might be a duck.
It might just be a duck. It might be a duck. So next week we're going to have Christian back on air. We're going to have to do a little bit of a little intervention if he's having the shakes, if you know what I mean.
I'm all for having an intervention for Christian.
It's a no rules intervention.
It is a no rules intervention, and it's going to be big no rules when we have to tell Christian that he's gay as well. So he's in for a rude awakening. In for a rude awakening. Alabama Shake my ass. No, there really is a band called Alabama Shakes, and they are. They're here in Charleston, and I know Christian and his Christian and his girlfriend are seeing them tonight. So we hope to have a great time, but alas, we're going to have an even better time because we are live, and he's going to be sitting in a chair with probably some very uncomfortable people who might smell not so great. I do want to start off first by showing the new by talking about the new website. Yes, we do have a new website. The other one crashed and burned, and we are very fortunate enough to have the original Mike J come back and help us with doing an amazing website. I've been on it for the last I've tried to get on it as much as I possibly could. But it's called myuncensoredradio.com. That's my and then uncensoredradio.com. And I think we're going to put that in the chat room. Go to it. It's fantastic. It's set up where each show, you'll have your guilty pleasures, and then you have the Jake Fetlin show, and then I think our show is next, and then there is Lips on the Air. And you can click on each of those groups, and it kind of talks about the host, and it brings up some featured episodes. It's a fantastic website, and I'm very, very proud of it. And there's also blogs. If you kind of scroll down past the pictures, you can read some of our blogs. I posted a couple of things, and I know that Jeffrey's been posting stuff, and I know that Lips has been posting things. So by all means, go check it out. Give us some feedback. We'd love to hear from you. But I have to say I'm very, very proud of our website. You guys can always find it, again, at myuncensoredradio.com. And there's links for you to follow us. There's links for you to friend us on Facebook. And there's also links for Pinterest. I did Pinterest once before. I don't do it all that much now. Well, now that it's becoming the holiday season, and I say the holiday season, I mean fall, which means everything from now until Christmas, I'll probably post something about it. I'm trying to keep that active for you guys. But by all means, you can follow any one of us, and we all have our little bio on there as well. So if you want to send us an email, you certainly can. So I'm glad I got that out there. I want to do weekend roundup and lowdown. Kirsten, how was your weekend?
It was actually really good. I went with a group of 11 riders and a total of 14 people. We rode 330 miles from central Illinois all the way up to the Wisconsin-Illinois border, hung out at a bar that is co-owned or friends of one of the riders who put this all together. So it was a long trip, but it was good to be away and kind of segregated from technology for a while, which was awesome.
Nice. Very nice. Now, do you do that all the time? Do you riding a lot, or is this something that's new for you?
This was something new for the central Illinois area. Since I've been back, I really haven't had a chance to ride too much with working retail life. So
right.
There was a guy that I went to high school with, actually two guys I went to high school with. He works for a local hospital, and he's an aviation mechanic. So he actually works on the helicopters off of the hospital. But he had his group of friends from the hospital put together this ride. So this is something relatively new, but something we're going to be doing frequently for sure.
Oh, that's fantastic. You should take some pictures and post it on our blog.
I'll see what I can do.
And what about your upcoming weekend? Do you have anything special planned?
Work. Yeah, since I had last weekend off, I'm working this weekend.
Oh.
Wah, 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 wah.
I know, right?
It's got to be hard working in retail when you have, like, one weekend off and then you have to work. It's kind of like, oh, what a bummer. Because, you know, you get that feeling where it's like, oh, I want to do this and I want to do this. And then it's like, well, shit, now I have to work again.
Yep. You know,
I don't envy you, but I hope you get a lot more weekends off than you do on. So.
And, well, me too. I hope so.
Nice. What about you, Tokyo? Did you have anything fun and exciting last weekend?
Not really. Just relaxed with a bunch of friends. Had my brother's girlfriend's best friend there, and we just all chilled and hung out. And it was a decent weekend. Week wasn't that great, but I don't want to get into show business on the air. But
we don't air our dirty laundry.
Yep. So
yeah, and I'm glad you got it taken care of. Yeah, I can understand that. I can understand that. Last weekend for me was, it was 3 shades short of amazing. It was fantastic, actually. I had a great weekend. I had a friend from, a longtime friend from Colorado come in. I've known him since we were both 17. And I'm 31 now, and I'm not good at math, so you guys do the math for me. But he's
years.
In Colorado. That's it. Thank you. They know somebody knows math here. We initially met in an LGBT chat room on AOL back when AOL was a thing. And he was a really good support system for me. He, you know, not knowing who he not you know, I've known him on the, you know, on the internet. But it was interesting to see how someone could, you know, call your bullshit, if you will. He wouldn't ever let me get too far ahead of myself. He would never let me become very self-indulgent. He was always just a good guy. I met him a couple of times in Denver, where he lives, and we became fast friends shortly after that. And this was his first time that he and his partner came to Charleston. So of course I had to be the hostess, and I had to take him around Charleston, and it was a lot of fun. Everybody knows what's been going on in Colorado with all the bad weather. You know, they've kind of skirted off on that, which we're very thankful for. But the minute they got off the airplane, it was like a deluge on Friday. It poured and poured and poured. And I'm like, it was sunny an hour ago. What the hell is going on? We actually, Matthew and I rented a beach house on Folly Beach. It's past an area called the Washout. And the house, it's a beautiful house. And out front, you have the ocean, and you have the ocean breeze, and it's amazing. And then, like, directly in the back, in the backyard, you have about, probably about 100 feet worth of grass, and then it turns into the salt marsh land. And it was just beautiful, you know. So we were able to watch the sunset in the marsh, and then we were able to, once it dried up, we were able to hop in the water. It was like 10:30 at night when we all went swimming in the water. It was a big surprise for them. They had no idea. And then we did the Charleston tour. We went to Magnolia Plantation, and I took them to an area called Avondale. For those of you in Charleston, you know where Avondale is. It's where Mellow Mushroom and Voodoo and Pearls and Hewton Top Brow is. We went there. And then, of course, we went clubbing downtown. And I realized probably about an hour after I got there that I was too old to club. I was kind of tired, actually. It was about, we got there probably about 10:30, and by 11:30 I was like, I really can just get into my pajamas and just sit in the bed. So I felt kind of old. My friend in Colorado and I, we are the same age, but he was just going. I was like, all right, we'll stay, we'll hang out. And then, you know, we did the downtown thing. We walked the Market Street, and we walked East Bay Street, and we walked down King Street, and, you know, we did that whole thing. So it was a lot of fun. I had a really good time. I'm exhausted. It takes a lot to recuperate from that, but it was a lot of fun.
Sounds like it was a blast, man.
It was. It was sad to see him. It was sad to see him go. You know, it's been about 10 years since we've seen each other last. So it was interesting just to kind of see, not so much how different we were, but just how much we've grown. You know, I think we were probably about 20, 21 when we last saw each other. So now it's an entire decade later. You know, I'm married, and I have a house and a dog, and, you know, an entire life here where the last time we saw each other, I was ready to move to Denver. So it's interesting just kind of like how the dynamics shifted. But he's always been a very good friend of mine. He will always be a very good friend of mine. I love him dearly. So it was really good to see. You know, speaking of, you know, meeting people on the internet, I think that, you know, nowadays, I think there's just so much drama on the internet, you know, internet bullying and stuff like that. I really think that there's really nothing sacred on the internet anymore. What are your thoughts on that, person?
Yeah, with the instant communication that we have now, we've got Facebook and Twitter and Vine and all these other Pinterest and all these other concepts of instant communication, which I do believe we've advanced as a society by having that instant communication. There are some huge downsides to that, for sure.
Yeah, and I definitely agree with you. I think that it's one of those things. If you're given an inch, you want a mile. And being that the internet is at this point an infinite being, it can go anywhere and do anything and see anything. Type in anything you want in Google, and I guarantee you will find it. Which is kind of scary. And it kind of leads into a story that I read on the Huffington Post. And it was about this guy who was breaking up with his girlfriend in the car and ended up that he decided he was going to create a Vine about it, which, you know, I feel is kind of classless. I feel it's kind of tacky. But
shady as hell.
It really is. I don't think the girl knew. If you guys, I'll post the link in the chat room, and you know, you guys tell me from your standpoint. I don't think the girl knew exactly what was going on until he actually made the statement. But it kind of begs the question: is anything really sacred, or is anything safe on the internet nowadays? And I don't think there is. I don't think there is a quote unquote line that people have on the internet, because a lot of it could be anonymity, and a lot of it could be you know, made up and factual. But you know, where does the line get crossed?
Yeah, so I was clicked on the link, and I had not seen this before, maybe 10, 15 minutes ago. I was looking at it, and my first reaction is, wow, how much guts does this guy have to post his breakup and his girlfriend, clearly giving him the business about what's going on. And then I stopped and thought about it, and I was like, we don't know this guy's name. We don't know who he is. So he's really just completely void of everything. So while he's posting his personal life out there, he's not really taking any accountability for it at all. And then the other side I had was, how do we know that this is true and real rather than just a made-up six-second clip to have a whole bunch of posts and get your internet fame for the brief 5 seconds?
My thoughts when you say this, Chris, automatically jump to the fiery twerking that Jimmy Kimmel did. You know, I mean, look at how quickly that blasted off, and everyone was talking about it, but then it was revealed it was completely and utterly 100% fake.
Yep.
True point. You know, I think what everybody does, and you know what, I am completely guilty of it. It's not necessarily that what I see on the internet I believe to be true, but because it's a one-sided conversation, and you'll never, I mean, it's rare that you'll get the other side, that you really kind of have to take it at face value. But at face value, this guy was really breaking up with his girlfriend in the car while he's driving. So, it could be a complete hoax, but it's not good enough to go viral like a lot of the other ones have.
Right. I mean, I'm on another one that isn't really a hoax. It was a contest that comes to mind, is that overly attached girlfriend. Look how fast that one hit everyone. Everyone knew about it for a while there.
Oh, was she the crazy chick with the crazy look on her face?
Yeah, the crazy chick with the crazy look on her face that did a song in response to one of, and I'm sorry if anyone gets offended by what I'm about to say, but it was a contest that Bitch Boy Bieber put out to do a parody of one of his songs. Stupid shit.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I've never seen it. I just know her by crazy look and picture, and that's kind of about it. But, you know, I think, is there anything that's safe from the internet? Is there anything that's protected? You know, I think what's really crazy is when you apply for a job, you really have to be careful, because these people can search you on Facebook, they can search you on Twitter, they can type you into Google, and God knows what's going to show up. So I really don't think that anything's really safe. I don't know.
Yeah,
Bruce, do you have anything on that one?
Well, just with the age of instant communication, anybody can get into anything that's been posted ever on the internet. Even though you may think that you posted this picture to Snapchat for 2 seconds or 6 seconds or whatever it is, once it's out there, it's out there. And if it's something that you don't want out on the internet, you should probably not have it in your social media whatsoever.
Exactly. I have to agree 100%, because putting anything out on the internet nowadays is just, I mean, I've told many, many people this myself. Don't share something you don't want known.
Yeah, my biggest thing is, I always tell everybody, don't put anything on your cell phone or anything on the internet that you don't want your grandma to see. And if you're not comfortable with your grandma seeing it, then probably shouldn't have it on there.
I agree. But, you know, there's only so much that you can do as far as on your end. But, you know, now Facebook likes to tag people, and they like to, you know, add people, you know, whenever they want. You can't really necessarily control that. And what happens if there is a I'm going to use the word compromising, not necessarily in, you know, a provocative way, but, you know, if there's a picture of you, you know, having, like, six beers in your hand and you just went for a job interview and you Google yourself and you find that it's on the internet, there's really, it's there's no way for you to remove that. There, it's there forever. So, you know, the internet is a great thing, but if there is a way to, I guess, censor it a little bit, I think would probably be a better thing for professionals in the long run. Like, I know that I don't want my boss to see any pictures of me doing anything that I wouldn't want them to know about. Not that I do an awful lot of bad stuff, but, you know, I don't know. It's a tricky question because I definitely believe in freedom of speech. I definitely believe in all that. But I think there should be a line with the internet that you shouldn't be able to cross. And I think a lot of people do.
Well, the other thing with the job aspect to it is you kind of have to take it for face value. So what you're saying is, you know, you don't want your boss to see that you, you know, went out the night before or the night of, you know, wherever and have six beers in your hand. The only thing that really proves that picture is that you're holding six beers. It never says you consumed or you had or you drove under the influence or any of that side to it. But it still gives that negative connotation of, this person has been photographed and is now it's documented proof that this person had six beers in their hand. So,
right,
it's got a good side. Yep, good side and a bad side. And if the employer or future employer sees you having six beers, and one of their big things as a company is no texting and driving, no drinking and driving, and they have that mindset and that mentality, you may have just shot yourself in the foot, and you may have not even drank any of it. It may have just been a staged picture.
Yep, absolutely. So the no rules rule is don't put anything on the internet that you don't want your grandma to see, because nine times out of ten, she's going to see it. I think that's amazing. I think that's a great little motto. I think we should post that in the chat room and on Twitter. I like it. But, you know, if we can...
It makes sense.
It does. You know, I was thinking about the actual video, you know, where the guy breaks up with a girl, and it got me thinking, and sometimes I can be nostalgic, sometimes I'm not, but it can be nostalgic. It was like, well, that sucks. I remember being broken up for the first time. And it kind of talked about, you know, I want to talk about your first heartbreak. It doesn't necessarily have to be about a relationship, but do you guys remember when your first heartbreak was? I know I do, and I'm pretty sure it's going to surprise a lot of people, but person, do you remember your first heartbreak?
I think you have a pretty good story. I think you should just roll with this one for right now.
So, my first heartbreak was... crap. Okay.
You just my got first... thrown under the bus.
And it's my own bus. That's the thing. I thought the person was going to go on, he was going to talk about a sad story, and he was going to cry. I was expecting that. You know, virtual tissues and whatever. Exactly. No, didn't escape this time. I could lie, though. But we came back to her house, and she proceeded to kiss me. And I did a little bit of straight makeout, and I was kind of left in awe because she got up and left shortly after, it wasn't shortly after, but we made out a little bit and, you know, hands went places and then she immediately left. And, you know, of course, I'm 9 years old and I'm thinking, oh my God, this is the best thing ever. I'm going to marry this girl. It's going to be great. And we're going to have three children and we're going to have a dog and we're going to have friends. And then I told a friend of mine at school what happened. And apparently, I wasn't the first person that she did this with. And I was crushed. I was completely crushed. Because I really liked her health. But she was a prostitute. Okay. Is what she was. Because they bought her a movie ticket, and sure as shit, she decided she was going to sleep with him. So I was crushed. I was just completely beside myself. And then a couple of years later, I realized that I like boys. So it was you know, it kind of was a wash in the end. But that was my first heartbreak. The only thing that I remember made me feel better is anybody who's from up north knows what a Carvel ice cream parlor is. I had a lot of Carvel ice cream. Carvel ice cream is probably the best ice cream known to man. They do soft serve, but they also do, you know, regular ice cream. They make their own ice cream in store. And my favorite ice cream is where they take their ice cream cake and they actually crumble it into one of those cardboard things that looks like a really, really large paper towel roll. And they just stuff the ice cream cake in there and they put it in a cone. That was my favorite. And it has vanilla ice cream with a layer of chocolate ice cream, and at the bottom it's like chocolate crunchy, almost like the little Hershey morsels that are all kind of crumbled up on the bottom, and then it's all kind of like mixed together. It's absolutely delicious. And I had a lot of that shortly after my breakup, if you will, or my heartbreak. So that's my story.
Was it truly a breakup, or was it just kind of didn't see eye to eye on what was going on?
Well, there was a little bit of the eye to eye that wasn't going, that, you know, because I already planned on marrying her.
But she didn't know it yet.
And I had no idea. And I already said that we're going to have so many children. I already said we're going to have a dog. And in my mind, this was going to go places. I was 9. So when I told her my thoughts, when I told friends about it. So. All right, first, it's your turn. I completely mortified myself on radio. So,
so my first, heartbreak can be tied back. I used to, in grade school, I went to an off-site community college during grade school to learn sign language, and it was, I think, every Sunday for a summer. So it was, I guess you could consider it like a summer fling, but it was, I can't even remember what grade, 3rd, 4th, 5th, maybe, somewhere around there. And I met this girl there named Susan, who I talked to her all the time. We hung out. We didn't ever do anything outside of class at all, and we never actually really got together by any means. But I had it all planned out that we were going to get the proverbial, going to get married, have 3 kids, have a dog and a white picket fence. And then after the class was done in the summertime, everything was gone. Never got a hold of her, never had her phone number, didn't know where she was. So it was kind of a shock, kind of like grief, the summertime fling, and then it was quickly ended.
Oh,
I know.
Sad. Don't you hate it when you like somebody and you're really into them and they give you 0 signs that they're not interested or they have no intentions on letting it go any further than what's right there? I think that's unfair. I think that's bullshit.
That they don't give you a heads up that they're not interested?
Yeah. Like, if you're not
interested, absolutely.
Don't let me believe that this is going to go someplace.
Yep, you know, just flat out tell me. I'm strong.
Yeah, yeah. And if I decide that I want to be an idiot and, you know, continue, then that's my own business. But you've given me fair warning that this is something that you don't, that you're not interested in. Don't lead me on. I don't like that.
Absolutely.
It hurts my feelings.
Your 9-year-old feelings, right?
Right.
But when I was a kid, you know, I didn't really have girls to be hanging out with as anything more than just friends for school. But when I got older, there was this woman. I'm going to just call her. I'm just not even going to name her. But I moved 2.5 hours west of my hometown just to be with her. And then within the month that I was there, I found out that she was cheating on me with someone who was like 5 years younger than me.
Ooh.
Wow. And therefore was underage.
Ooh.
Strike 2.
So,
yeah.
strike two. Let's get strike three out of the way then. She had a dildo the size of frickin', let's put it this way, about 2 foot long and
oh
3 inches
oh
around. God.
No.
No rules, no mics.
Oh my God, I cannot believe we're talking.
Oh God. Seriously? This is supposed to be a classy show.
No, but I'm just saying that's when you see that
so,
kind of thing, you kind of feel inferior.
So, Toki, you said you moved 2.5 hours for this lady, correct?
Yeah.
What happened after, we'll say, the ultimate demise? Did you move back? Did you stay out there? What happened?
I moved back to my hometown, and that's where I am at now. But
gotcha.
it's just the fact that, you know, this girl felt that... And I'm going to make Topher cringe again just by saying this.
No, please don't
but,
talk about it. I don't want to hear about it. I want something else.
Mondo Dong?
Oh, my God. Here we go. All right. Get past this. Hurry up. Get past this.
No, but it felt like if she felt that was better than me, then what point do I have of even living there?
Absolutely.
You
so,
don't.
And
you apparently have
you
to be an elephant.
Yeah.
Wow. So I know that Toku said he moved back. What about you, Topher? Have you talked to this lady since or kept up with her at all?
What's really interesting is that I tried to look her up on Facebook the other day. I forgot about her completely, but I tried to look her up on Facebook the other day, and I found somebody who kind of resembles her, but proportionately, that's not who I thought that she doesn't look like I thought that she would look like. So I don't think that's her. So she looks very, very different, but it might be her. I don't know.
So you haven't been able to track her down at all?
No, I haven't. I moved away I moved away probably a couple years later. I was probably about 11 or 12 when I moved away from that area in Long Island. And then I haven't seen her since. I haven't kept in contact with her. But when I was setting up the show lineup, it kind of got me to thinking about her. I was like, you know what, I'm going to see if I can find her on Facebook. And I found somebody that kind of looks like her, but it's one of those profiles where it just shows a picture and not a whole lot else, so I don't know where she lives, I don't know any of that stuff, so...
Not enough to try and friend to find out if it's actually her or not.
Correct. What about you?
A privacy person, someone who believes in privacy.
That wouldn't work anyway, because, you know, one, I'm gay, two, I'm not private at all. Everybody knows all my stuff. But what about you, Burson? Have you tried to get in contact with this other girl?
I know her first name, and I would know her last name from when she was growing up as a kid. But I've searched her a little bit, not put, like, a whole lot of effort into it. But she is, as far as I can tell, she is not on the social grid whatsoever.
I gotcha. I have a best friend like that who was in Long Island. There was nothing ever, I guess you can call it romantic, with us. But, you know, when I moved to Charleston back in 97, we kind of lost contact. But once, you know, Facebook and MySpace came up, I was instantly trying to find her, and I can't find her. So there are people who are interested in the social media, and there's other people who like their privacy and, you know, who decide that they don't want to be a part of it at all. I'm assuming that this is Allison in the chat room who's saying that her first breakup had to be when she was in pre-K, and she liked a kid named Jeff, and in her mind, she was going to get married and have kids. Apparently, when you like somebody a lot when you're younger, you automatically want to get married and have children, which I think is so sweet. She says it didn't happen. He also kissed while we were learning our ABCs. Interesting. And then she says, my mom ended up getting me some cool toys as a kid. Okay.
Maybe, yeah, maybe it was for the breakup, mending the heart. You just get some cool toys and kind of move on.
You know what? A coloring book and a 64-pack of Crayola back in the day was all I needed. That was good.
I could see you doing that.
I could see that.
A coloring book and 64-pack of Crayola leaves me as an adult, let alone a kid.
You know what? I agree. Adults do not color enough. If everybody colored, there'd be less wars, there'd be less fighting, there'd be less hatred. And the only thing that you'd be pissed off is that you colored outside the line. I'm just saying. Take that with
maybe that's a little grain of salt. Maybe that's what we should tell maybe some of our politicians to do. Just go ahead and bring out a coloring book and we can fix it all.
Right. And not just like coloring book on like a table, but like laying on your stomach with your feet kind of kicking in the air in the bag, and that's all you color. That's
halfway
how you
color. Halfway laying on a pillow with maybe a blanket covering your feet.
Exactly. That's how you color like a boss, my friend. That's how you color like a boss.
Like a ball.
Oh, gosh. You know, it brings me to another topic, and I hate jumping topics to topics, but I think it kind of has its own flow. You know, we were talking about how, you know, people kind of like to be out of the limelight. People don't want to be on Facebook. They'd rather not have that social media connection. I have a thing for Zac Efron, and I'm not afraid to admit it. And I was beside myself when I realized that he finished a stint in rehab for alcohol abuse. I read the article on E! Online, I think it was this afternoon, and I was like, what the hell do you mean he went into rehab? When the hell did that happen? Because trust me, I know exactly what Efron does. I don't recall any of that. There was nothing in the news. There was nothing in the media. There was nothing. It was completely silent. I'm going to start off by saying, number one, I'm glad that he's happy. I'm glad that he's healthy, and I'm glad that he's not drinking. I'm glad that he's back at work, because I know that he's set up to do a movie, so that he's in works in a movie. But my topic on this one is Zac Efron can do a stint in rehab under the wire, and nobody knows about it. And then you turn around, and on the flip side, you have all of these Lindsay Lohans, all of these Paris Hiltons, all of these, who got out of rehab? Amanda Bynes, all these celebrities that when they're walking down the street, you know when they're going to the bathroom, you know when they're going back into rehab for the fifth time. You know, is the public invading these people's spaces, or are these celebrities force feeding, you know, the public their dirty laundry, if you will. Because, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, there was nothing about Zac Efron in the news going to rehab, or that he had a problem that he was going into rehab. But everybody else seems to like to publicize it. I don't know. What are your thoughts?
So, I didn't know anything about it. I don't know too much about Zac Efron. I'm not going to lie. I don't know too much just about him as a celebrity in general. But from what I can tell, he's not into social media as much as some of the other ones. He didn't publicize this. It wasn't something that he said, hey, I'm going to rehab. I'm going to send this out to my publicist, and then my publicist is going to have a meeting and say everything about how I'm going to be in rehab and please respect my time and all this stuff, which is fantastic. The thing I think about is for somebody to be able to go into rehab, first off, they admitted, A, I have a problem, B, I need help, and C, I can keep this private. And with anybody that I've, for celebrities so far that I've seen with rehab that's been publicized, Paris Hilton, Charlie Sheen, Lindsay Lohan, they haven't, while they're okay, maybe in society, they're not the stellar celebrities that we once thought they were when they were first in. And somebody who can first admit that they have a problem, which is fantastic. Second one, admit that they can't finish or they can't complete what they need to, or they can't get sober on their own, and then being able to keep it private, I think is fantastic. So I think it's kind of twofold. I think maybe the big celebrities are telling their publicists, hey, go ahead and let everybody know, so that way when I'm not on social media, everybody doesn't assume I'm dead. And then the other side to it is that maybe the public is eating all of this up because we're so, what we were talking about earlier, instant communication gratified, that if we don't hear from a celebrity on Twitter for a couple of days, we instantly assume the worst.
True. And you bring up a lot of really good points that I haven't thought about, you know. You're right. It's the celebrities that you don't want to hear from that are blowing up your Twitter, that are blowing up Facebook, that are in the Huffington Post and E! Online and People Magazine, and they're everywhere. But it's, you know, I guess it's reassuring to know that's not all, you know, celebrities, that these people choose that lifestyle, that these people choose a lifestyle where they do not have privacy. So I think, you know, when you look back on all the celebrities who say, oh, I have no privacy, everybody's all up in my business, this kind of, and it's probably, I'm probably making a bigger thing out of, you know, something that's not that, but it turns all of these public celebrity woes into, well, you kind of brought this whole thing on yourself because you allowed that to happen. Apparently you can control it because Zac Efron did it and nobody knew that he was in rehab. So you can control it. So what does that say about the person who is publicizing it? Are they doing it for publicity only, or are they really doing it for help? I don't know.
I think that really it boils down to Zach has become the exception to the rule, because most of your celebrities really want, like, the public to know what's going on because, well, they want to stay in the spotlight. It seems to me, and this is just my opinion, that Zach Efron doesn't really want to be as much in the spotlight unless he's doing something to deserve said spotlight. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely what it should be. If you're not putting out something for the fans, it's none of my business what toilet paper you buy. It's none of my business if, you know, what you do when you're not at work. That's none of my business. I just want to know when your next album is coming out. I want to know when your next movie is coming out. Blah, blah, blah. I don't care about your private life because that has nothing to do with me.
Well, I think the Lindsay Lohans and the Charlie Sheens, they almost had to tell their publicist, go ahead and let everybody know that I'm going to be in rehab and I'll be gone for a little while, because of that instant communication that they started off their careers with. And once the Twitters of the world and Facebook started blowing up and Instagram and all these other social media sites, once a celebrity has gone down that path of instant communication, if the general public doesn't hear from them for a while, we instantly assume the worst. Maybe they're not telling us they went to rehab. Maybe they got in a car crash or they're in an accident, or we instantly think the worst. And we've kind of done that to ourselves as a society, but the celebrity has put themselves in that situation by making themselves instant communicable. Available all the time. There we go.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
And being an at tag away can either be doom or a great thing. I mean, look at us and Uncensored and AMC. We're all one at tag away, you know?
Right. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So I guess if you guys don't hear from me for a while, I'm going to go through rehab. Just going to throw that out.
Well, you can go with Christian, because apparently he has a problem.
Oh, maybe that's why we haven't heard from Christian. Maybe he's in rehab from the Alabama.
That's what it is. Oh, my gosh. He's going to kill us a lot. You know, so that brings a good point. So I think that, you know, celebrities get to put all their business in the news. And, you know, people eat it up with, you know, a lot of people I'm not saying everybody. A lot of people eat it up with a spoon. They want to know. They have to know. They feel like it's important to them to know. They feel like it's their right as a fan to know, you know, the personal triumphs and the downfalls of their idol or their celebrity. But what's really funny is that we bash the hell out of our Facebook friends when they go on their little soapbox tirades or when they're having a problem. It's, we don't need to know that. We just want to know that you're happy. We want your happy post. We want this and we want that from you. But I can give, I don't care about your sad breakup, and I don't want to read about your Facebook post that's very vague, but apparently it's meant to be for somebody, but you're not saying who it is. Quite frankly, I delete those people. I have nothing to do with those people because they drive me batshit crazy. And I think it kind of goes along the lines of, you know, with celebrities. But I don't even know all that. If you want to put it out there, that's fine. That's none of my business. Just put out an album, make another movie. I'm good. What do you think? Do you agree that we bash the non-celebrities for laying out all their dirty laundry, and on the flip side, any celebrity who lays out their dirty laundry, that a lot of people just kind of heat it up with a spoon?
Yeah. I want to say no, but absolutely, yeah.
And that's really weird, because we probably have a better connection with some of our Facebook friends than we do with any of these celebrities. We're probably never going to meet any of these people. But yet we're so involved in their life that we kind of make it a point to follow that. But anybody in our personal life who's having a problem, we don't have the time of day for.
So are you saying that you're never going to meet Zac Efron?
Oh, no, I have every intention of meeting him.
Okay.
But he didn't publicize that he was going to rehab or that he had a problem. It was so, after the fact. You know, after I'm done, after it's all said and done, I can now come out and say, I'm happy, I'm sober, I'm getting ready to go back to work. It's not so much, Zac Efron's going down a spiral path, and there's no Star magazines or People magazines or Us magazines or pictures of him saying that he's overdosing or that this, that, and the other. If he's gone through his sip and rehab, and now he's a better person, he's not drinking, he's sober, he's ready to go back to work, he's happy, he feels great. It kind of eliminates all that excess bullshit that I think would happen had he said something sooner. So
Zac Efron,
bravo.
If you're listening,
yeah.
We'd love to have you call in or chime in on this. Just let us know. And Topher would really like to meet you.
Dan, Skippy Hippy. Sorry, I got a little excited there. Oof. Okay. All right. Wow. Yeah, so if we can get Zac Efron on the show, I think that'd be fantastic. A little flustered here. I'm going to do a complete 180 conversation because that went a little bit too far on my end. I've been very personal tonight. I don't know what's wrong with me. I've been divulging a whole lot of not secrets per se, but I've been talking a lot, probably more than I should. So I'm going to.
Oh, but it's your show.
Nope. Keep going. Keep talking more. Let's go. It's okay.
this is where Christian is important, because Christian likes to talk just as much as I do. Do not let him tell you that he doesn't, because when you give that boy a microphone, he does not shut up. And this is going on. And we're going here. We're talking about this, and I'm going to go here. And this is great. And my girlfriend, this. And we went below. And I love my dog. He can help me fill this weird silence, so I don't have to put my foot in my mouth every 5 minutes.
So Christian, if you're listening to this post, not live, obviously, if you're listening to this, I am not asking you. Just going to throw that out there. I am not doing this.
That is BS. You were absolutely bashing him earlier. Although I think we're all bashing him.
We're innocent until proven guilty.
You know what? We have video evidence or audio evidence. I.e. this show, that we're bashing the hell out of Christian. Hey. You know, he deserves
well,
it. He should be on the show. Damn it.
He shouldn't have took a week off.
He shouldn't have. You know what? He's going to pay dearly next week. So I'm going to have him in the middle of the sentence. I'm just going to hit the mute button. He's going to hear, muted. It's going to be awesome. He's going to know that I did it. He's going to know that I did it, too. You watch. That fucker is going to know. We're down to our last 7 minutes, and I wanted to make sure that we had as least time as possible to talk about this, because this can go in a lot of different directions. I like to title this a modern day Pope, and everybody knows what I'm talking about. Pope Francis was in the Huffington Post. I'm sorry, I like to quote my sources that way I don't get arrested for slander. In Huffington Post, Pope Francis was quoted saying things about, you know, the Catholic Church's quote unquote obsession about gay marriage, abortion, and contraception. You know, I read the article, and it was a really, really good article, and it really gave me a glimmer of hope and light for the religious folk. For those of you who have not read the article, we're going to put that in the chat room so you guys can read it. It's a good article. It's not, you know, something by any means. It's a very well-written article, and I'm going to give you some of the quotes on Pope Francis. It's very progressive. You know, just his thoughts and ideas are very progressive. And I know that the LGBT community has been kind of reaching out and giving him, you know, a proverbial pat on the back for what he's been saying. But, you know, first quote is that he says, you know, the church can share its views on homosexuality, abortion, and other issues, but should not, quote unquote, interfere spiritually with the lives of gays and lesbians. And coming from a pope of all people, and we all know that the popes in the past have not been all that forthcoming with gay marriage, and they haven't been all that forthcoming with abortion and contraceptives.
Yes.
Okay. And things like that. Sorry, it's not a word I use all that often.
I know. I'm just getting a chuckle out of it.
I know you are. And then he says, the church can share its views on homosexuality, abortion. I'm sorry, I read that one already. The church has sometimes locked itself up in small things, in small-minded rules. That's a quote that he said. But my favorite one, I know we're kind of short on time, is he says, I don't remember the context, actually, but I wrote down the quote because I thought it was beautiful. He says, tell me, when God looks at a gay person, does he endorse the existence of the person with love? Or does he reject and condemn this person? We must always consider the person. Here we enter into the mystery of a human being. Again, Pope Francis was quoted saying that on the Huffington Post. And I think it's a great thing for society and for everybody to realize here is somebody who kind of holds a very prestigious role, who's, you know, known as, you know, the religious right-hand man, if you will. Gerson, what are your thoughts real quick on what the Pope is saying? Were you able to get a chance to read the article?
I had a chance to skim through it, and the one quote that really stood out to me was, it was five words. And he said, who am I to judge? So he recognizes that he's not, and not to get too religious, but whoever you pray to or whoever you think the higher being is, he's not the ultimate decision maker. He's supposed to be spreading peace and love and harmony and all of God's children or to whomever you pray to. But he said, who am I to judge? So when he came out and said, really look at the person and don't focus on their sexuality, I think it speaks bounds for what the Catholic religion is going to. I'm not saying that it will get to that point where they will be accepting of, but it's just another thought in looking at it as an overall thing rather than just a homosexual thing.
You know, I cannot agree with you anymore. It's profound. Coming from somebody of that caliber, it's refreshing. But I wonder if he's going to get any backlash from this.
Oh, you know he will.
Yeah, you're going to have the what they call right-wingers that are going to be completely against this, and he should not be Pope because it's going against everything that the Bible speaks for. And but when push comes to shove, his five words of "Who am I to judge?" is the catch-all for everything. And he's 100% accurate in saying, who is he to judge? Who am I to judge? Who is anyone else to judge this one individual for what their sexual preferences are, race, religion, color, creed, any of it at all?
Exactly. Yeah. Right here, and you just hit the nail on the head there, because it's going to be the people like your George Bushes, like your, Glenn Beck, like your Fox Newses, that are going to say the Pope is wrong. The Pope is wrong. I don't give a shit that he's the religious leader. He's wrong, and he should be condemned for even thinking this shit. And you guys know as well as I do, it's going to happen.
Yeah, and you're right. But I'd like to have kind of sleep well tonight, knowing that here is essentially the living father of religion in the Vatican, who is quite content. He knows where he stands with in his position, and he knows. I think what it is that he knows his place. He's not saying that he is God. So why is he to judge as a God?
Exactly. And I gotta publicly say thank you for saying that and being the upstanding person you are, Pope Francis. I have hope for humanity.
Yeah, as do I. All right, so we're down to our last minute, guys. It was amazing. That went so fast. I hope you guys had a lot of fun, because I know I did, divulging all of my personal secrets.
And now it's documented.
So, real quick, I need you guys to tune in next week. We have a special celebrity guest. Her name is Nikki Dinky. She is a finalist from Season 9's Next Food Network Star. She's going to be joining us on Thursday to talk about her time on the show and what she's been up to recently. So I hope you guys tune in. Person and Toku, thank you guys so much for tuning in and listening. And thank you guys for joining us on the radio. And I hope everybody has a great night.
Have a good one, everyone.
Thanks to everybody for listening.
Have a good one, everyone.
Thank you, everybody.
Are you ready for this one?
UCR.
Go.
We're saying what we want. Give it to you, not go. Any place, any time. Not afraid to speak our mind. That's just the way we roll. We never gonna go. Unstoppable, original, uncensored radio.
It is, Thursday, and I am totally excited, as I know Jeffrey is very excited as well, because guess what, folks? We have New York Times best-selling author Steve Alton here with us tonight. I mean, can it get any better than that? It's one day until Friday, and we have a New York Times best-selling author on our show. I'm just almost speechless.
Well, I know anybody that is listening has heard me talk about him. Quite a bit the last couple of weeks, just because, I find the books amazing. They're fast-paced. The amount of research that he puts into these books, I can't put them down. I can't read them fast enough. I mean, I've read every novel he's done so far, and I have really no complaints. They're just that good.
Always a good thing. I mean, I almost feel like, it's good to hear that, there's still good books out there. I mean, not that there aren't good books, but it's almost like books have sort of fallen by the wayside as we get more into this, new age of social media and constant contact with Twitter on our phones. And, you can be in the restroom stall and you're on Facebook on your iPhone.
Right.
It's
e-book thing?
I'm not a fan. I'm really not.
I know he's working on it, and I'll let him tell about what he's got coming up, and I think it's this month. I have one, and it's just not the same as picking up a book. for me. It's just completely different. I have a harder time focusing on it. But I do, I mean, it's for convenience-wise, I mean, it's awesome. But I just, the feel of the book, I don't know. I can't get over it. And I'm just, I can't express the excitement that I have that he's going to be on with us in just a few seconds. Like, it's just amazing. And I feel like a total geek because I'm, like, so excited. You know, it's, for other people, it's like they're famous celebrity. Ah! You know, and this is somebody that I've read for years that I respect and admire so much. And then to hear his personal journey, it's just been amazing to me. And I can't wait for him to share that with everybody. It's just, it's unreal.
Yeah,
so
I'm actually really excited about it. And for you guys listening online as well as over the phone, if you you know, want to share anything, we've got the chat room going. So if you're at the blogtalkradio.com/unscripted, you know, go ahead, scroll down to the chat room. We've got Madison on with us as always tonight. Hey, Maddie, what's up?
Hi.
Oh, there you are.
Hi.
We were looking for you. Hello.
What was it? Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi. All right. Well, are you going to say something other than hi?
All I was going to say is that it's been a long day. It involved troopers, an alternator, and Auburn, New York, and flamingos.
And
well,
yeah,
flamingos.
If you would have read Grim Reaper End of Days, honey, it would have been nothing compared to what you're about to hear.
Uh-oh. Uh-oh.
Oh, yes. So, without further ado, let's bring Steve Alton on with us.
Yay!
Can you hear me?
Hello, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Hi, Steve.
Thank you so much.
I appreciate the kind introduction. That was very nice of you.
Well, it's the truth.
I'll certainly try to live up to it.
Well, you've done good so far, and I've been on the edge of my seat for like 2 summers now, waiting for the last book in the Domain series. I'm like, come on, it's got to come. I need it.
Well, I hate to disappoint you, but Phobos won't be the last one. There'll be one more after it. No, I changed my mind and extended the series.
Oh, that just makes me even more excited.
Only because the storyline asked for it, but Phobos, I think, is my favorite of the three books so far. It's so much fun.
When I first got into it, like, I guess I didn't realize what I was getting into, and I am a very paranoid person about the end of the world, 2012, and aliens. Like, I just get uncomfortable, and when I got, like, you know, partway through it, and I realized what was going on, I was like, I had to stop reading it for a day because I got so nervous. I'm like, I was actually like, this could happen. Like, it was just so real to me. Like, this could really happen.
I really hate to say this to you, but he's also scared of cats, too. So, it's not saying too much about him.
Well, just,
Steve, I got to tell you that when Jeffrey was reading this book, it was like every 5 minutes I was getting a text message. And he's like, oh, my God, I'm so freaked out. You have no idea about this book and the calendar. And it just opened up a Pandora's box. It took weeks to calm him down.
Well, Domain was actually written back in 1998. And so it was sort of ahead of the curve with the 2012 stuff. And for that reason, the book sold okay in the United States. But about 7 or 8 years later, it took off in Spain. It became the number one book in Spain, and it took off in Mexico and Germany and Italy, and now it's having a nice run in the United Kingdom. So I'm very curious and hopeful to see how Phobos does in October.
I have a feeling it's going to do very well. Especially, I mean, the timing couldn't be better for it to come out. I mean, people are starting to get a little nervous.
I think the 2012 movie helped a lot, although it didn't really focus on the Mayan calendar and teach us what that deal was all about. It just sort of tied into the date in a brief dialogue, and that was that. And,
I know that was
the eye candy
like
started.
I thought it was going to go in, and it didn't. I was kind of disappointed. And that just, I mean, especially after reading your books, I was like, come on, give me more. But it's still pretty scary stuff. Do you believe the world's going to end in 2012?
I believe that we're rapidly coming to a fork in the road, and it's going to be sort of a judgment day in some sense. You know, all these natural disasters that are happening, all the things that are going on in the world, you know, everything from peak oil to just to, you know, the overwhelming greed and corruption that's going on in the world. And you know, I was just watching Keith Olbermann, who I love his show, and the Ohio congressman who has steadfastly been pushing to take away the vote from minorities and older people and the like, and was forcing Ohioans to have driver's licenses with them when they voted, got pulled over for a DUI, didn't have his license, and had a hooker in the car. So, you know, that's the kind of thing that's coming up in 2012. You know, what goes around is going to come around. Yeah.
I agree. Like, I don't know if it necessarily will be the end of the world, but I feel like something's coming. And I mean, just our, you know, our planet is due for some kind of a switch. Like, I think it's had enough of us abusing it. And the greed, and just, I mean, even in the shell game, the things that you wrote about, I was like, you know, it's something that I guess I didn't think about before. And that book made me stop and think about a lot of things that I guess I just hadn't really put thought into it before with the government and oil. And it just kind of stopped me in my tracks and made me think, like, yeah, something's seriously wrong.
Well, not all the books, but a lot of the books try to take on reality in a, you know, and open your eyes to things that are actually happening out there and tell it in the form of a fictional story that,
right,
you know, can have a greater impact than just a documentary or a nonfiction book.
Absolutely. I mean, and that's, I think, what it's made me so attached to your books is that you take fiction and you bend it with the truth so much that it almost becomes hard to separate the fact from the fiction.
I'm curious, Steve, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Madison.
I just wanted to know, like, I mean, obviously with writing these books and even hearing Jeffrey, you know, react to it, and obviously dealing with the extreme nature or even happening of basically karma catching up with us in 2012, what do you think is the craziest reaction you've gotten from maybe one of your readers or one of your fans to what you've written? You know, what was the craziest response that you got because of one of your books?
Crazy response. I think I had an email from a woman who decided that she was the reincarnation of Lilith, who was one of the characters in the books. And, you know, I said that, you know, I tried to talk her down and said, that's not who you are. You're not a succubus and you're not this evil creature. You're, you know, so let's get off of that.
And that character is definitely evil.
But she changes in Phobos.
Me a little bit.
Well, she's scary in Resurrection, but things have come around in Phobos, and it's an interesting plot line because you may actually like her in an evil sort of way.
I mean, I know, like, with the, you have the newsletter that you send out monthly, which I have, like, three different emails, and each one of them get it. So whichever one I've checked first at the beginning of the month, I have the update. And when you sent out and you gave, you know, your fans the preview, I couldn't, I was like, we got to, like, the last page in the preview, and I'm like, no! I mean, to see what that character went through as a child and what she was kind of able to accomplish, I guess, was kind of a big thing. I mean, obviously, you know, she's kind of superhuman, but it was amazing to me that the character evolved into what she did. And she
had
the plan.
Well, you've only seen the beginning of the iceberg, so.
I can't wait.
Yeah, that's a fun story. And scary, because there is a threat out there that could take us down in 2012, and you know, it's a crazy situation. It's driven by the ego of scientists who are hunting the Pulitzer, or not the Pulitzer, but the Nobel Prize, and you know, they basically built this machine in Geneva underground that collides protons at near light speed, and in an attempt to recreate the Big Bang. And it's an insane prospect, because in the process of doing so, they're creating miniature black holes. And one type of this black hole is called a stranglet. And a stranglet has the ability to escape the chamber and grow larger. And so why are they doing this? Well, they're doing it because they're in search of something called the Boson-Higgs element, which is nicknamed the God particle. And it's ironic that they should name something the God particle when they're trying to act like God. And, you know, if there's anything that we've learned about atoms, is that you don't split them and you don't smash them together, because nothing good can happen from those two processes.
How about just not try to play God? Like, that in itself is just scary enough.
Yeah, I mean, there's no information that they're going to gain from that that's going to, you know, lead us down the journey of Star Trek or Voyage to the Stars or anything like that. It's just, you know, they're just theoretical, you know, quantum physics, and it's no good can happen from it.
It's like little boys drinking Pop Rocks and eating Pop Rocks and drinking soda. They're doing an experiment just to really see what happens. And I think they're messing with things that they don't really know what they're getting into.
Well, it's one thing to mess with yourself, and it's another thing to create a situation where the entire planet can get sucked into a black hole that you've created. And, you know, that's unfortunately a possibility. And that's the threat in Phobos.
And I love how in the book you have, like, the timeline of how it's just this, like, almost continuous loop. Like, I thought that was a very neat concept, and it kind of actually made me feel a little better when I got to that part, because I'm like, well, okay, if it ends in 2012, we'll just start over and see what happens this time.
Like, yeah, not this time around.
Yeah, we're going to do it a little better. Like, it was just, I don't know, I couldn't put it down. And even in Grim Reaper, how really, I mean, it was like the end of days, but by our own hand. That, I mean, I'm not even sure. Like, and at first, honestly, I read the, you know, the blurb about it, and then I pre-ordered it, and it was great because it came out right up, like, by my birthday. So I was like, woohoo, happy birthday. But I was like, I don't know, like, Grim Reaper? Like, what's this going to be about? And then I read it, and it was another one I couldn't put down. It amazes me how you've been able to tie in what I didn't know how you were going to do it. And it ended up being this amazing book that I was like, again, like, this is stuff that we need to really be careful with what we're messing with.
Well,
biological issues,
you know, for your listeners, the basic story behind Grim Reaper, and Grim Reaper is a very layered story, is that a biochemical scientist who works at Fort Detrick introduces a man-made version of the bubonic plague at the UN, believing that she is the tool to introduce revelations to the world. and you know, she's a little bit psychotic. But these biowarfare weapons are actually being made as we speak at Fort Detrick, Maryland, and Battelle Labs in Ohio, and you know, it's scary stuff. And you know, there's something in the Bible that basically states that when negativity, you know, the scales of justice are you know, pulled toward negativity and darkness, that the angel of death will walk the earth. And there's been several times in the history of mankind that the angel of death has walked the earth. The first time, you know, depending upon what you take out of it, is the story of Noah, when Noah built an ark not to carry animals but to keep the angel of death out. Because civilization at that point had grown so negative, and so much corruption and so much greed and negativity and hatred in the world, that God said, okay, enough's enough. You build yourself an ark to keep the angel of death out, because that's it. The second time, which is a little bit scarier, happened in 1346, when bubonic plague raced out of Asia and crossed into Europe and Africa, and was so devastating that it wiped out 60% of the entire world's population. And this was at a time, you know, in 1346 that, you know, people got around on horseback you know, they did have ships, sailing ships, but, you know, the vector was the flea, and the flea bit the rat, and the rat passed on bubonic plague to humans. What's scary is that between 2012, which is the Mayan's doomsday, and 1346, which is when bubonic plague started, the amount of years difference is 666.
Hmm.
So, you know, that's the next time that the Grim Reaper is supposed to make its appearance.
And that's what I love, that you've incorporated all of these, you know, facts, and, I mean, you know, some people may call them myths, whatever, into the books, and it's just, I just can't say enough how it just captivates you and keeps you like, oh, wow, you know, like, it's just, it's amazing, and in Grim Reaper, it's just, when we had Anthrax, like, I kept thinking about that, and, like, this is dangerous stuff. We should not be messing with things that we can't fix. And, I mean, I don't really want to give away the book, but what happened, you know, it got loose in New York, and what were they going to do? There was no way to control it. But to kind of eradicate the whole city. I mean, and that's something that could be a very realistic thing in the near future if we let it go on. It was very frightening. But, and I loved your author's note. Just, I mean, it moved me when I read it to find out what had happened to you. Can you share with everybody what happened to you on May 5th in 2009 with your wife?
Well, it was during the writing of Grim Reaper, and Grim Reaper is a book about good and evil, and you know, cause and effect. And on that night, my wife had gone to a vitamin shop around the neighborhood, and while she was in there, two armed men in masks came in with guns and robbed the place, and basically took her and a clerk and duct taped them to the floor and bound them and gagged them and put a gun to their head. And you know, that could have been it. And, you know, it's a scary situation. And in the author's note, you know, I basically state that, you know, I had been introduced to Kabbalah, which is a study of spirituality and sort of the science of spirituality that is 4,000 years old and comes from the Book of Formation, which was written by Abraham, the patriarch, and, you know, had something horrible happen to my wife, had she not survived, I don't know what I would have done. And it sort of put me in the same shoes as my lead character, who had a family situation as well.
It definitely, I mean, I read that and I just, my heart stopped for you because I couldn't imagine. And just the fact that you were writing this book about good and evil and something like that happens. And I mean, and just to go through that, I mean, with your wife, I can't even imagine how hard that must have been after for her. Just to, I'm sure that she had tons of emotions that just,
she did.
I wouldn't know how to go back out to the store.
Well, what helped her is that her Kabbalah teacher explained to her that, you know, it's possible that her presence there, you know, kept people from getting hurt. That, you know, her belief in you know, the Creator's light and kept her safe and kept them safe. So that gave her something that she could live with. And so that helped.
I mean, no, it's amazing. I love in here you say, but who knows, perhaps one day the man who held a gun to my soulmate's head will pick up this novel and garner the spiritual tools he needs to transform his own life. So from that, I'm assuming he wasn't caught.
No, he wasn't caught. And, you know, and the premise behind that is that from the greatest darkness has the potential for the greatest light. And so, you know, even someone who's done horrible things can transform their behavior and contribute to society in a positive way and, you know, bring light to the world.
And I thought, you know, that was so, I mean, honorable of you to put that in there. And I just thought, how amazing would it be if that person does read the book someday, finds out that it was your wife, and reads that, and maybe it will change his life. And hopefully for the better. I mean, it's just, it's unreal that these things happen, and it just, and the way that it happened. And I feel bad because also you've lost your father recently.
Yeah, it's been rough.
And then, 2007, right? You were diagnosed with Parkinson's?
Yeah.
And how, and I know that's definitely been affected in your life, as you shared with us in the newsletters. Can you, how has it changed your life, I guess?
Well, you know, everybody has challenges, and I certainly have mine. And there, you know, from my perspective, there are people who have it a lot worse than I do.
Right.
So, you know, I consider myself lucky for the problems that I have. How does Parkinson's affect me? Well, it affects the right side of my body. Sometimes it's noticeable, sometimes it's not. It's something that causes rigidity, so that it feels like, you know, at times there's, you know, lead flowing through the blood in my wrist or my forearm. And it can get a little uncomfortable at times, but, you know, my choice of combating it is not to go on drugs.
Wow.
Because the drugs can cause the same symptoms as Parkinson's. Michael J. Fox went on the drugs in an attempt to continue his acting career, and they put him on heavy drugs right away, and, you know, the heavy drugs are dopamine, because Parkinson's is a lack of dopamine, which helps you control the muscular impulses and nerve impulses. So they put you on dopamine, and then your body gets used to it, and you have to go on more dopamine and more dopamine, and I just didn't want to do that. So I take a half a pill, which is an Azelec, which is a drug that's not dopamine, which doesn't affect me, but it's said that it could push the symptoms away for some years so that it doesn't worsen. But I've also had a stem cell treatment that is sort of a breakthrough going on here in Boynton Beach, Florida, where there's a doctor who has discovered that by releasing your body's own stem cells in large quantities for on and off periods, the stem cells, you know, are sort of like a universal healer going through your own body and can help restore some of the stolen effects of Parkinson's. So I had that done last summer. I hope to have it done again because it definitely did help.
Wow. Is it something that you're going to have to, like, continue to get yearly?
No, I don't think so. I think for the people that I've met who have Parkinson's who underwent the treatment, their results were a little bit better than mine was because their symptoms were a lot worse.
Right.
It's also possible that I've discovered that I had high levels of metal in my body, mercury and lead, which has been taken out through chelation process. And I think that the stem cell treatment would have probably worked better if I had had that done first, but I didn't know.
Right. Isn't that really dangerous to have that removed? I was just reading about that the other night.
It's not dangerous to have it removed. It's the process of removing it is actually simple, but you can pick things up in the environment or, I mean, even certain types of shampoos have metals in them or you know, you never know what you're going to. I mean, I'm pretty careful about the things that I eat, but you never know what it's from. So, you know, and we don't live in an area that has high pollution, air pollution, and we drink water that's purified through reverse osmosis. So, but you just never know what's in your body. And I think those things can contribute to disease.
Right. Well, I mean, it amazes me. I mean, even just looking at Michael J. Fox, to see, I mean, 10 years ago, to where he is now, I mean, it's very heartbreaking. And I mean, from looking at it from my perspective, from growing up with him, I mean, it seemed, even though he had it for so long, it seemed to me like it happened very rapidly once, like, he was on Spin City and he had to leave. Like, so, I mean, to me, like, that was very scary. And when I first, you know, read that you had it, I was like, how is this guy going to continue to write?
Well, people get it in varying degrees, and he's sort of the poster child for Parkinson's along with Muhammad Ali, but, you know, my symptoms are nowhere near like that. I mean, you can see me, and I can just be sitting there, and you wouldn't know that I had Parkinson's. Usually I don't have too many tremors. Sometimes I have no tremors at all. So exercise is a big thing that helps Parkinson's, and I've always been an exercise demon. And I've always taken care of myself that way. And so I find that when I work out, you know, the Parkinson's symptoms lessen. So I work out. So it's sort of a motivating factor to get my ass to the gym at 11 o'clock at night if I haven't gone. And then, you know, I'm fortunate in the gym and that I work out. It stays late, it stays open late, so it accommodates my schedule.
I can't imagine. I mean, how is the writing process? Do you bury yourself in a room for days on end when you get into a writing mode? Like, how do you have time for your family in the gym? And I mean, just dealing with the doctor.
Well, you know, it's you know, I work out of my house and I have an office upstairs, and you know, every day is a little bit different. You know, I'm working on a new project right now. A new novel called The Omega Project, but, you know, I started my day and checked my email, and my agent had emailed me, and he said he sold the rights to Goliath to Spain. And
for a movie?
No, for novel, the novel rights. And Goliath is a book that was written in probably 99, actually, I think it was 2001, I think I finished it right after the September 11th. So, you know, a lot of things have changed in the story of Goliath because, you know, it deals with a submarine that basically goes after the guy who hijacks the sub, uses it as a tool to fight dictatorships and authoritarian governments. And the computer that's in charge of the ship has a mind of its own and is learning from the bad guys. So, but in the original book, Iraq was nuked, and Saddam was still around. And since then, obviously, things have changed. So I need to go back before we send it to Spain and swap out a couple nations here and there. And it means me going through the whole book. So instead of writing the Omega Project today, I've spent the days on Goliath. So every day is a little bit different, and you have to sort of adjust your schedule based upon the needs of publishers and or movie deals or whatever it might be. And that can take a while.
Right. And now, are we going to be getting a sequel in America to Goliath anytime soon?
Well, the storyline of the Omega Project is actually what was originally Sorceress, and it was just such a great storyline that everyone who heard it said, you got to let it stand on its own. So I sort of put Sorceress on the back end and back burner and started working on Omega.
I mean, I am definitely a person when I've read the books like Goliath, it's just one of those books like one is not enough. There's just so, I know there's more of a story, especially the way it was ended, which is kind of like, I'll be back. And it's just like, yeah. And now, am I crazy, or was there a little tie-in with the submarine in one of your other books?
Well, I had used the name Goliath in the trench for this big oil tanker that had been converted to a fusion reactor. But when the storyline for Goliath came out, I wanted to use the name. So it's not really much of a tie-in. They share the same name, but a little different.
Oh, I thought there was something with the... one of the guys maybe from MAG that had actually created the submarine. I could have just connected it all in my own head, though.
I think you may have.
It happens. I'm just, like, always looking. I don't know. But I that was another one that I couldn't put down. I think I had read it in less than a day. It was just, it's an amazing book. And then, of course, what got me started, I did a cross-reference because I had a very, very hard time reading as a child. And it stuck with me to adulthood where maybe I'd read a book a year. And then I picked up this one book when I was nannying. I couldn't put it down. And then that was it. So I did a cross-reference, and your name came up for Meg. And I loved Jaws as a child. Loved it. I remember when the movies were on USA, we'd tape them on our, VHS player and watch them. So when I was like, oh, a shark book? I'm like, this, I ran to the library and I got the book. It was another one I couldn't put down. And I was just so captivated. I'm like, it makes Jaws look like a goldfish. I mean, how did you come up with that concept?
For Meg?
Yeah.
I also liked Jaws when I was growing up, and in addition to reading Jaws, I read, a lot of great white shark attack stories that really happened, and there was always a little blurb about Carcharodon megalodon, the prehistoric cousin of the great white, but there was never anything commercially written about it. And when I was 35 and juggling my career a little bit, I picked up a Time magazine, and on the front page, on the cover, was the Mariana Trench, which is the deepest part of the planet, 7 miles down this 1,500-mile-long gorge. And as I read it, I read the article, and I read about hydrothermal vents and the different sort of species in the abyss. I recall the little blurb about Megalodon, and immediately went to the library because there was no internet back then in 95 and all the way back then. And I searched the shark books until I found the picture. And I set a goal that I was going to write this book, and I was going to take 30 days to research it as much as I could. And then I'd start writing it. And because I had a job, what I call a J-O-B, just over broke, the only time I could work on the book was at 10 o'clock at night till 3 in the morning and on weekends. And so I set up shop in my living room table and with the dining room table, and which kind of pissed my wife off a little bit. And I said, this is what I want to do. So I basically by writing 2 to 3 pages a night, I was able to finish it in about 6 months. And start to search for an agent. And, you know, Meg was actually my first book and the biggest deal that I've gotten on a book deal.
And
been a roller coaster ever since.
Was that your first time that you decided you want to write with this book? Because I know before it said that you had a general manager's job at a wholesale meat plant.
How do you go from that to writing? I had gone to school as a physical education major, and I actually wanted to coach basketball. And I went through 10 straight years of college to get a doctorate degree to have something to fall back on. And my last year of writing a dissertation, I happened upon a job selling water treatment equipment, whole house water treatment equipment, and turned out to be pretty good at it. And to the point that they offered me to open a factory distributorship in Wilmington, Delaware, and I did that for a while, and things went into a little bit of a roller coaster there, and ended up moving to Florida and opened up a smaller company and teetered with that a little bit and then bounced around on a couple different jobs. From the water treatment company, I had set things up that I was working for myself essentially because the overhead was just too high. And one day I got this weird call from a guy who said, "Is this Steve Alton?" I said, "Yeah." And he said, "I could have been your father." And I just sort of wondered what kind of genetic mishap I had been involved in. And it turns out that the guy used to date my mother when she was 17 years old, and for some reason he decided to check up on me. And he invited me to his company to meet him, and it turns out he owned this wholesale meat company. And 2 hours later, I had talked myself into a job as a sales manager and got out of the water industry and was working for him, and he promoted me to general manager in 6 months. And things were going so well that the board of directors made up of his stepsons decided that they didn't need me anymore. So on Friday the 13th, on September 1996, I lost my job. And 4 days later, Meg was auctioned to the 6 biggest publishing houses in New York and garnered this huge deal.
I mean, that's what dreams are made of right there. I can't imagine a better story.
Well, you know, there's more to the story. You know, Meg had been optioned. We had gotten an option from Hollywood Pictures before the book went on auction, and that's what pushed up the deal. But it was part of a 2-book deal, and the second part of the book deal was this Mayan calendar story, which at the time was called Fathom. And when I went to write the book, I wanted to tell the story of the Mayan calendar and the publishing house Bantam Doubleday, which did Jaws 25 years earlier. All they wanted was an underwater story. And Domain is not an underwater story. I mean, there's elements of it that are underwater, but it's the calendar story. And rather than make a fuss because so much money was at stake, I just wrote the book that they wanted me to write, and it wasn't very good. And 2 weeks before I was supposed to get paid $1 million, if you can believe that, they canceled the book. And, you know, that was, you know, like a pretty bad punch in the gut. And I had just moved in, my family and I had just moved into a brand new house from an apartment, and I knew I was going to lose the house, and I had just gotten a brand new car, and I knew I was going to lose the car, and all the little toys that I bought on the first deal, I knew I was going to lose, because I owed taxes to the government and was planning on paying those things with the book deal. But we settled. I had to sue them, and we settled out of court, so that I could get the rights back to the book. And I took some time off because I had spent 2 years with it, and wrote Trench, which was sold to a second publisher. And by that time, I'd gotten the rights back to the book that would eventually become Domain, and sold that. So, you know, I was able to write the ship. But you know, it definitely Bantam Doubleday. In order to save face, because Meg had been such a big bestseller, you know, that they had to justify firing the author but what had happened was it wasn't the book that they fired me for. It was the fact that Doubleday had been purchased by Bertelsmann, which is this huge German conglomerate, and the outgoing president, Arlene Friedman, was trying to make her bottom line look better to keep her job. So anyone who had been given a high advance in the beginning, they, by dropping their contracts, they could save the advance, and that would have made her books look better. And so myself and a few other authors were caught up in that mess, and it was not very good.
I can't imagine. That's tough. I mean, that, to have all of that, like, handed and then pretty much taken away, that is just...
Well, you know, I could say it now, I couldn't say it at the time, but, you know, there was the positive in the negative, you know, the silver lining was that it forced me to become a better author. It forced me to be more concerned with my character development and elements of the story and the writing. Because Meg had done really well because everybody loves reading about a 70-foot great white shark, but... You know, at some point you have to develop into becoming a better writer, and this was the impetus that forced me to become a better writer and learn my craft, and my books are far better now. Every book is a little bit better. I mean, I spent the day working on Goliath. Goliath was the fourth book that I wrote, and Omega is the 12th, and between the fourth and the 12th, I've become a better writer. So as I'm reading the passages, I'm changing them now because I don't like, you know, some of the wording, and I want to make it a little bit better.
And I mean,
but you can drive yourself crazy doing that. You know, writing is editing, and you can edit yourself into a corner.
God bless you, because I mean, Mike can attest to this. Not like, and I'm sure you can probably even acknowledge it, because when I send an email, like, my grammar is horrible. I would have loved to have been a writer, but I have no imagination. I can write a blog, but I can't write. So to see, like, it just amazes me that the stories that, I mean, you've come up with, like, I don't think I could ever be that creative. And it's just the way, I mean, it's captivating, because I didn't think it was just a shark book. Like, there was, like, science involved with, you know, the trench and the submarines. I don't know, I thought it was better than Jaws. There was more to the story, and more science.
Well, from my major criticism of Jaws, I mean, how do you criticize Peter Benchley in 10 million books sold? But
right.
And he certainly was an amazing writer. But the one thing that, if for me as a 15-year-old reading Jaws, was that I wanted more shark.
Right.
I mean, any chapter that was about the shark was cool, but it was like it was a tease. And then we had to listen to Brody and him, you know, and or Hooper urinating in Ellen Brody's bathroom or whatever it might be. And, you know, that's all fine, but, you know, let's get back to the shark. So yeah, when I wrote Meg, you know, I made sure that there was a lot of shark in the book. And when I wrote Hell's Aquarium, you know, I have dueling stories going on between one shark story and the other shark story. So, you know, you get plenty of action.
And that was exciting, especially because we learned what other creatures are in the trench. I was like, oh, we could go lots of places with this. Is there possibly any spinoffs coming?
Not a spinoff. There'll be one more book in the Meg series, Night Stalkers, but... I won't even start that until the Meg movie moves into production.
Yeah. Oh, that is a great thing, which I also wanted to cover, because I keep seeing it's going into production, it's in development hell, it's a possibility. What is the latest update on the Meg movie?
Well, you know, just as a backstory, Meg was optioned before my first book deal. And Hollywood Pictures bought it, which is part of Disney, and they went through two lousy scripts. You know, the rights were reverted when the president of Hollywood Pictures, David Vogel, was fired. So the rights came back to me, and nothing happened for a while. And then through my friend Nick Nunziata, who's the founder of Chud, we got the book to Guillermo del Toro and Lloyd Levin and Larry Gordon, and they loved it, and they took my script that I had written at the time, and then Jan DeBont was added to the mix, who was the director of Twister, and Jan had his own take on the story, and so we worked on a script together, and we sent it to New Line, and New Line optioned it, but New Line wanted to work with Shane Salerno, who wanted to work with Meg, so Shane Salerno rewrote the book as a script, and unfortunately, Shane went, you know, way out in left field.
Wasn't there something about a flying shark or something somewhere?
No, the flying shark script came from Hollywood Pictures. Shane's contribution was to make the shark growl, to which I said that if you don't remove the growl, I'm going to go postal on all of you and kill you.
yeah. Wasn't it growling in Jaws 4?
Yeah, something like that.
Shark
made, you know.
Yeah, and it was, like, insane. Like, what the hell is the shark doing?
But Shane basically wrote Moby Dick with a shark, and to New Line's credit, they didn't like it. But the rights reverted again, and then I had a friendship with producer Belle Avery, who's not a big-time producer, but what she's good at is sourcing money. And she's
nice.
Got a lot of contacts, and she basically said, well, let's shed all the, you know, the garbage that's attached to this book and go write a new script and, you know, stay on the novel. And I did, and we worked on the script together, and it's a great script. In fact, we showed my script and Shane Salerno's script to 25 people and took our names off of it, and all 25 overwhelmingly voted for my script. And
nice.
Couldn't wait to see the movie. So with that script, we went out and got financing, and we have some bigwigs over in China are going to finance it for $150 million, and they're at the point now where they're just finalizing the paperwork. You know, it'll be an American movie and with American director or maybe a Chinese director, I don't know. But, you know, it'll be first class all the way, and the script's good. So,
well,
you know, the most important thing about
a fat dude that they need to kill in the first 10 minutes, tell them to call me. I would just love, like, when you did the contest, it's like, I want to be a dead body. But I cannot wait. I think this movie will be huge. I believe it to be huge. And personally,
I think it will, too. I mean, I think it's going to be the number one grossing movie of all time for its time, for its period, but
I agree.
If it's done right, and I think that it will be done right, and it starts with a good script and good characters and good storyline, and you can't depend upon the special effects. If you have a good story, then the special effects just aid the story.
Right. Well, I think, too, because you wrote the book, the script needs to come from you. Like, I don't want to see somebody else's script on the movie screen. I read the book. I want to see how you would translate the book into a movie, not somebody else. And I think that's where books and I can't stand it. I cannot read a book and watch a movie. It just doesn't work for me because the book always blows away the movie.
And there's a reason for that, and that's because two reasons. One is because the author sweats the details and gets the story right, whereas a screenwriter doesn't have the time to investigate, do the research on a story, so they come up with the first thing they come up with. And the second reason is because the WGA, the Writers Guild, sets up a rule which deals with subsidiary rights and royalties and things like that, and that is that if you want credit for the script, you have to have changed at least 30% of the original material. So they automatically build in change from the original source material. So for something like Meg, which has undergone several scripts, everyone who takes it it's sort of whispered down the lane. The original message is so blurred by the time it gets back to you because everyone's changing it. Whereas for me, the author, I don't care about the credit because I wrote the novel. I just want the best script. I just want the best storyline. And
there has not been a shark movie that, I mean, there was that one, like 10 years ago, other than Jaws, really. Like,
well, the funny thing about Deep Blue Sea is that when Meg was originally optioned, the agent in charge of the option worked for ICM, Jeff Robinoff. And he and David Vogel, the head of Hollywood Pictures, did not like each other. But he optioned him Meg, and while Meg was in development, Robinoff became the head of Warner Brothers. And so he greenlit Deep Blue Sea to try to attack David Vogel. Not because it was so, and ironically, Deep Blue Sea was the picture that got made and not Meg.
I mean, and even for me, like, I watched that movie, I can't even count how many times, just because I was so desperate for a shark movie.
Like, well, I think there is a 3D shark movie coming out this summer, which looks really stupid, but
Like, they had anything with the water, I'm obsessed with, and I'm mortified of the ocean, but I just love it. Like, they had that Piranha movie, and I was like, okay. Yeah, not so much. So I have been, like, waiting. So I'm hoping and praying that this movie comes out soon. And it would have been great if it comes out before the end of the world. I'm not going to be happy if I have to go and don't get to see Meg on the big screen, okay?
You and me both.
Well, we have just a few minutes left, and I know you have some exciting news about an e-book that's coming out, right, relatively soon?
Yeah, I mean, it should be in July. What happened was, I think Meg was the only book, that possibly the Trench 2, that didn't come out as an e-book. And with publishers, the publisher who options the book gets all the e-book rights. But Meg has been through some weird situations. It was originally, printed by Bantam Doubleday, and then when we knew New Line Cinema was buying the rights to the book, my friend purchased the rights back because he had a publishing company, and so Tsunami Books published it for a couple years. And then Tsunami Books went out of business, and I had to buy the rights back to Meg, and the problem was that the book went out of print. And the Adopt an Author program, which is the program I founded that helps high school reluctant readers, had 10,000 teachers, and the 5,000 active ones were using the book. And so they had run out of books for their classroom, so I had to get the book back into print immediately. So I optioned it to the movie producer, and she had the book printed up and for the teachers. But she had never done the e-book. So we have a company that just does e-books is going to do Meg, and they said, well, as sort of a free giveaway or a 99-cent giveaway, can you write a prequel? And I said, well, actually, Meg lends itself to a prequel because the story deals with what happened to Jonas Taylor 7 years ago,
right. But
never really delves into it too much. So the Meg prequel is what happened 7 years ago. It's the entire story. But it's only, maybe an 85-page book. And
well, it's 85 pages I'm looking forward to.
It's so fun.
I cannot wait.
And for people who like Meg, there's like little things in the book that they'll be like, oh, man, that's cool because I know what happens to him or I know what happens to her. And, I don't know if it's not going to be printed. It'll just be an e-book because it's a giveaway. And I have to think of a way to get it to readers who don't have, Kindles or, whatever.
Well, I just got the first e-book, and I'm telling you, I'm not loving it so far. There's just nothing the same as a book.
There's
but.
Nothing like a I'm not an e-book fan. I prefer to hold a book and turn the pages mm-hmm. myself. And
I like seeing it on my shelf after I've done reading it, and then I go back,
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. It's just something about the physical, the smell, the touching, the turning of the page. Like, I just love it. I mean, e-book thing, but I'm telling you, I'm on this. The prequel, I cannot wait. Do you have an exact date of when it's coming out?
Not yet. I just did the final edit on it a day before the newsletter came out. So they're reading it now, and once they give the thumbs up, they'll give me a date. I'm guessing towards the end of the month, but if you check on Amazon, once they announce it, it'll be announced.
Well, Steve, I cannot thank you enough for coming on. I mean, I could probably spend a week just talking to you about the books, and I'm really upset that I didn't get enough time to talk about Adopt the Author program that you started, so I'm hoping that you will come on with us again, and we can talk about that more. And I'm hoping you'll come on again, too, the next time your books are coming out, because I just can't get enough. And I just want, all of my friends, I've promoted them on Facebook, I've told everybody they've got to read them, and I'm just honored that you came on with us. So anytime you want to come on, you've got something going on, please let us know, and you are more than welcome. And I definitely would like to do more with Adopt an Author, because I think it's a great thing that you did for a lot of kids.
Well, I appreciate that, and, we'll stay in touch, and I'll come on again.
Yeah. Well, and that's one of the great things about you, I have to say, is I have emailed you numerous times throughout my different emails, and I'm like, God, this guy's got to be, I'm got to be driving him crazy. You have emailed me back every time I've had a question about a book or anything, and I really appreciate that, and I think that's what makes you such a great author. To do that for your fans, that's just amazing.
Well, without my fans, I don't have a career, so.
Well, I want to thank you again, Steve, for coming on, and I will definitely be emailing you so we can hopefully get something set up with Adopt an Author, maybe get some people that are involved in it as well with you. I want to thank you for coming on. We've got about 30 seconds left, everybody. I want to thank everybody that's listening. I can't thank Steve enough. I can't believe it's over. I'm kind of disappointed. But we will see you all tomorrow. And make sure you visit our website to get the link to Steve's site and get his books, guys. You're going to love them. You will not be able to put them down. We will see you tomorrow. Bye.
Bye, everybody.
This has been a presentation of Unscripted Radio.